Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, I want to welcome you back to another edition of The Orthodox Medievalist today. I want to thank all my listeners. I want to thank all of those who have praised me as well as all of those that have criticized me. I don't get a chance to really get online very often and read the blog and read the other things that happen in kind of the social networking on Voice of Reason or anything else. So I don't get a chance to answer any kind of criticisms or any kind of support. I apologize for that, but I really only use the computer system when absolutely necessary. So I'm not ignoring you, if that's what you're wondering. And I know I've said this before, but it is the case. I am not ignoring you. I just want to keep my connection to technology at a minimum. Today we're going to talk about something that we haven't dealt with before, at least not in this level of detail. We're going to talk about Ukraine under the Soviet Union and some of its features, and specifically a few of the resistance movements that that were founded in Ukraine in the 30s and 40s. And I know a lot of this through my own research that I've been, you know, doing and specializing in this stuff for so many years. But I also know it from interviews, from listening to firsthand accounts. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this before, but when I was in grad school, I lived amidst and among the Ukrainian diaspora in just outside of Lincoln, Nebraska. And they very much became my, you know, family away from home. I was, of course, part of the, you know, I became Orthodox then. I became part of the Ukrainian church then and was even on the parish council for a while. So I heard a lot of these stories, and so I know for a fact that they're true and that their stories are largely ignored by the media. And we all know why that's the case. And they all strongly suggest that the persecution, at least in Western Ukraine, was done overwhelmingly by Jews who were in some kind of sympathy with the Soviet Union. And that's something that is a historical fact and needs to be taken seriously by journalists, historians, and those in the academy. But, of course, that's highly unlikely to ever be the case. So the first thing that the Soviets were concerned with in taking over the Ukraine, number one, was to eliminate the German presence. You've guys got to remember that at the end of World War I, the German army had taken large sections of Western Ukraine, and it was considered to be a means whereby Germany can, in fact, have a new lease on life. When the Germans take Western and Central Ukraine in 1918, not only the German high command, but the German population was of the impression that now we have these brand new food supplies. We now occupy an extremely fertile area that the Austrians were incapable of occupying, because the Russians had largely had their way with the Austrians, but then struggled to fight the Germans at the same time. Remember, German policy was really vitiated by the Russians because it was understood in 1914 that the Austrians and then later the Bulgarians could take care of the Russians. Remember, Bulgaria had actually been bribed to go over to the Central Powers, while Germany will spend most of its treasure on France and England. Because Russia largely defeated, generally speaking, the Austrian armies. In fact, the Serbs by themselves had made mincemeat of the Austrian forces. Germany fairly early on was forced to then split itself and transfer some of its big guns and some of its better infantry over to the Eastern Front. And it really, it's for that reason that, the World War I lasted as long as it did, was as bloody as it did, and even by 1918, by all accounts, was a complete stalemate. So the occupation of Western Ukraine was a huge victory for the Germans because they figured now we have this beautiful source of food, and we have a population that to some extent does not like the Russian occupation, and as a result looks to Germany as allies. This also means that the Ukrainian parliament and the declaration of an independent Ukrainian republic was made possible and then ratified by the German government and the German army. Therefore, the soon-to-be Soviet government is now being financed by the United States, as it was always financed by the United States, with the understanding that it must drive the Germans out of Ukraine. This was something that wasn't necessarily envisaged by the Allied powers. That now that the Germans had a brand new source of manpower, a relatively sympathetic source of manpower, and a new source of food. But as was the case in wars in the early 20th century, unfortunately, the occupying powers made life very difficult for the Ukrainians because what they were doing was then taking grain and taking cattle and taking implements without recompense. So as the war comes to a close, the German forces are basically isolated in Ukraine, and you have a back-and-forth battle very early on between the remnants of the German army, the white forces which have developed in around the Odessa region, and then, of course, the Bolshevik movement itself. So eventually, as we all know, the Germans will disintegrate. The whites, due to a whole host of reasons, and I actually have some publications on this question on my website and on my journal, and the whole horrible, disastrous behavior of the white forces, not only relative to Russians, but most certainly relative to Ukraine. And the white army shot itself in the foot by coming out rather vehemently that it does not accept an independent Ukraine and will never accept an independent Ukraine. So you have a ragtag Ukrainian army connected to the old Rada, or the parliament. The Rada is sort of like the Russian Duma. Who actually the Rada really didn't have an army whatsoever, and had no bureaucracy whatsoever. Really, more or less a symbolic movement. And really had no way to defend itself. The Cossacks were deeply divided. The pro-German coup of the Cossack Hetman Skoropadze, although Skoropadze did spend money on education and on infrastructure, was very quickly overthrown. You had really ragtag bands of armed Ukrainians throughout the countryside with no particular organization. And that was made worse once the Germans had disintegrated. The whites made themselves very unwelcome, and it was their own fault that they made themselves very unwelcome. And so as a result, the Bolsheviks were able to take over Ukraine very early. And this was a big problem. We recall that the Bolsheviks had made a separate peace although the Provisionals were interested in continuing the war, the Bolsheviks had made a separate peace which gave substantial parts of Ukraine away to the Germans. But once Germany was no longer a factor, it didn't take much effort for the Bolsheviks to then reinvade Ukraine, drive the remnants of the Germans out, and then create the so-called Ukrainian Soviet Republic, which was based in the more Russified East, and the capital of that republic was not Kiev, but Kharkiv, in the far east where Khrushchev was born. The Bolsheviks sought to impose their will on Ukraine. And the religious campaign under Lenin and, of course, Trotsky, Bernstein, this was really the first set of movements to pacify the country. And what Lenin and Bernstein would do is simply go through the country and show a lot of anti-religious films to the population. And they would say that science has proven that God does not exist. Really nobody in the scientific world believes in God anymore. And of course, to become a truly enlightened member of the new world, God has to be eliminated. To some extent that worked. For the most part, it failed. I mean, these were very poorly, organized meetings, and these were very poorly filmed, commentaries. So the next step was that the Bolsheviks began paying people. They began paying local Jewish communities, and they began paying local criminals to begin destroying churches and destroying religious items. Anything of value, like some of the vestments and some of the chalices and things like that, were then delivered for the Bolsheviks, and that became a small part of their income. But throughout all these problems, we're talking really from 1918 now to the early 20s, Ukraine was a complete disaster. Grain production had plummeted by more than half by the mid 1920s, and a lot of this partially was due to rebellion. I mean, early on, Ukrainian farmers were not about to sell their grain for worthless rubles. And partially because the farmers were not going to sell or assist the Bolshevik movement at any level whatsoever. And given the nature of the economy, it was far easier to hoard grain and to slaughter cattle than rather eat them themselves rather than sell them to the Bolsheviks or anything else. But as always, Woodrow Wilson's American Relief Association, the ARA, came to the rescue. The ARA was an organization really designed to assist in the consolidation of the Bolshevik Revolution, and they sent tons of food aid through the Black Sea and into the Jewish-controlled port of Odessa. Odessa had always been a major banking center and a major, huge Jewish community there. And the Odessa Soviet cooperated with the ARA, and, of course, food aid was then distributed to Ukraine, to the Bolshevik forces. And that was one of the major pillars in the final Red Army victory in that country. So between 1929 and 1930, given all that I've said, about 200,000 private farms were liquidated and destroyed. Which is ironic because, the slogans that the Bolsheviks had promoted, that were written on all of their banners and were stated in all of their pamphlets and books, was that we want a redistribution of the land to the peasants. The problem is that the Bolsheviks didn't believe in private property. Therefore, they could only consistently desire land to be redistributed, but of course only to the party. But what this means in reality is that all that Bolshevism ever was in Ukraine or in Russia itself was a huge wealth transfer from the farmers to the party members. And so because the party apparatus in Ukraine and that and those parts of Russia were disproportionately Jewish, what Bolshevism really was and what Marxism really is even today is a demand for a massive income transfer from the peasants of Ukraine, who normally were peasant farmers. They were yeomen. They did own huge amounts of land, which they worked themselves in relatively small plots, that was to be transferred to the Jewish party apparatus in Ukraine. And that's exactly what happened. So within a few years, in 1929 alone, 200,000 private farms were given to the party apparatus. More and more were granted as the early 1930s went on. At the same time, roughly 1.2 million Ukrainian farmers were deported throughout other parts of the now developing Soviet Union. What the Soviets put in its place was large collective farms known as the Sovkhoz. There were actually several versions of that. We'll deal with that at some other time. But between 1932 and 1933, you had this redistribution of land controlled entirely by the party apparatus and those individuals who controlled it in order to make what Lenin and Bernstein really called, agricultural factories. And that's what farming was to become. And that was the nature of the collective farm. And you either joined the collective farm or you were shot or you simply starved to death. Because there was no food permitted outside of the Sovkhoz system. By 1933, it was very clear that there was a mass desertion and mass absenteeism from the Sovkhoz system. It was this that had Stalin develop the idea of genocide for the Ukrainian population. That it doesn't mean anything to us if we can capture the breadbasket of Europe, and Ukraine certainly was that, if these people are going to refuse to work the land. These goyim are tremendously nationalistic, and these goyim are stubborn, and they need to be taught a lesson. But it was Nikita Khrushchev who finally admitted that this was the case, that this occurred, and these were the reasons that it occurred. And we all know that the New York Times, that the American academic establishment was covering over these crimes and covering over the mass starvation policies that existed, partially because of the absenteeism and the boycotting of the collective farm system on the one hand, as well as the forcible prevention of food aid either from Russia or from the West. The Soviet Union was consistently receiving American food aid throughout this period of time, and it seems to me almost impossible that the Soviet Union could have ever consolidated without American food aid throughout this period of time. But from Stalin's point of view, what needed to happen was that these goyim needed to be completely eliminated and destroyed. So deportation, execution, starvation, this became the means of destroying Ukraine, destroying nationalism, which, as always, is the great enemy of these modern ideological systems, liberalism, capitalism, Soviet communism, nationalism has always been the thorn in their side. And really, from Stalin's point of view, the only way to deal with it is through extreme uses of violence, starvation, and complete genocide. And again, while the American academic establishment, while the government, while the journalists in the West were covering this up, not only covering this up, but lionizing the Soviet system, both the British and the Americans were sending official government delegations to Stalin's Russia, and Stalin would show them all of these smiling peasants and all of these new tractor factories, and they'd go back and they'd say that history has reached its end in the glorious experiment of the Soviet Union. You guys have to realize the open support of Soviet Marxism in England and in America, and the churches included, of course, because they were, you know, a lot of the Protestants in particular were just complete whores. The Catholics were iffy on the matter because the popes really liked the idea that the Russian Orthodox Church was now completely decimated and hence no longer a threat to them, but of course hated the idea of an atheist and materialist system. So the Catholics were kind of iffy on these questions. Most of the Protestant establishment, with some notable exceptions, were lionizing the Soviet system. So almost every element of the American and British establishment were openly supporting the Soviet system. Those of Ukrainian and Russian ancestry who had immigrated to England and the United States were largely in their own communities and were not speaking English. And so their ability to communicate with the masses of America was a real problem. It wasn't until generations later where they began speaking English and began proselytizing in the Orthodox faith, and the Slavic worldview, did the truth of this come out. But of course, all of this eventually, in the late 1950s, were finally admitted in full by Nikita Khrushchev. So this was the nature of the system. And also keep something else in mind, that the lionization, the support, the devotion, particularly in elite university circles, had reached such a fever pitch, and American investment in the Soviet Union began to increase tremendously. So much of the early Soviet industrial development was based on American, British, and French capital. And even somebody who was often supported in nationalist circles, Henry Ford, in the mid-1930s, built a humongous tractor factory just outside of Odessa in Ukraine, assisting the Soviet industrialization of that very strategic part of the new Soviet Union. And that's really the tragedy of the 1920s and the 1930s here. A new system of education was then imposed. And of course, the education and the propaganda needed to then fall on the heels of the destruction of the old order. And it was called the Hirenko system of education, developed in the early 1920s. Where children were taken from the home at 4 years old, and from 4 to 8, they were educated and propagandized in what were called children's communes. And then from 8 to 15, they were then moved from the communes and brought to something that was called a socialized upbringing or a socialized form of education. And from 8 to 9 years old, they were required to join the Komsomol, or the Pioneers, the communist version of the Cub Scouts. But then after all that was done, you had the option of 3 years of professional training, and then 2 years after that, of higher education in the academy. And Stalin really began to stress this five-year period because of the shortage of skilled labor that you had amongst Ukrainians. Ukrainians are largely a agricultural people. They wanted to remain an agricultural people, but Stalin's forced industrialization with Western assistance, loans, credits, as well as direct investment, as in Ford's case, this really required a higher level of education in terms of technology. As party members were recruited from this new Ukrainian elite, of course you couldn't be an elite unless you were a party member. Party members and the children had their own schools that were completely segregated from the regular schools, and they essentially were to be trained to be Soviet ideologues specializing in certain areas, whether it be in terms of writing, a military, industrial, whatever it happens to be. And all lectures from the children's communes all the way up to the academy, every lecture was taped and then reviewed by party members. And I'll have you know that that's exactly the case today in the American university, where all lectures are monitored, all lectures are transcribed, and are sent to what's called learning services, where they are screened so that no professor can ever say what he wants and will be eliminated for political correctness. And that's exactly what happened to me at Mount St. Mary's University. All lectures are screened. All lectures are transcribed. And so ultimately, 3 million Ukrainians who were not murdered were deported. They were deported to Central Asia. They were deported to Siberia. The purpose there was to attempt to number one, remove any kind of ethnic unity on Ukrainian territory, but number two, to use Ukrainian, a very vaunted, very famous Ukrainian agricultural expertise, and bring it to areas that are not well developed, like Siberia, like Central Asia, and that also was continued under Khrushchev. So, when we come back, we're going to deal with, and just a thumbnail sketch here about various forms of resistance that the Ukrainians in and outside of the country will be engaging in to fight the Soviet Union. So we will return in just one second.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, welcome back to the Orthodox Medievalist. We're dealing today with the early years of Ukraine under the Soviet Union, the methods of controlling the population. But today, and for the rest of the show, we're going to deal with just a few issues in terms of resistance. But resistance doesn't develop, in terms of an organized movement until the German invasion of 1941. The German invasion of 1941 was a double-edged sword for Ukraine. was one of Hitler's great mistakes, and in my opinion, is one of the main reasons, if not the central reason, that he lost the war against the Soviet Union. On the one hand, the German invasion gave the Ukrainian resistance movement breathing room to organize and to function. But I don't want anyone to think that Hitler or any of his, or people like Rosenberg, Frank, these people who were sent to Ukraine to oversee the operation, trusted the Ukrainian population. They did not. Number one, they didn't trust Ukrainians because they were Slavs. And according to the German mythology, Slavs were not European. They were basically of Mongol or Turkic stock, and therefore were Untermensch, and they were not to be taken seriously as Europeans. They were not Aryans. And number two, German intelligence had this very, it was an error that they made over and over again, at least on the Eastern Front. And that is, whenever they captured a Russian or a Ukrainian or a Belarusian, they immediately assumed that they were loyal to the Soviet Union. And I know this, I've heard this from people who experienced this firsthand. I've heard this from the Pulaski family, who was in fact captured both by NKVD and by the National Socialists. And, you know, they couldn't get it straight. It's almost as if Hitler underestimated the level of oppression that the Ukrainians were put under. So when the SS moved into Ukraine, they engaged in the same grain requisitioning tactics that the Germans in World War One had done. They did not trust the population, and yet they could have had a huge reserve army of Ukrainians that could have been armed and trained and sent against the Soviet Union. Hitler failed to do this. It wasn't until the very end of the war, when it was too late, when he finally considered creating a Ukrainian SS division. But by then, it was simply too late. It was a huge error on Hitler's part. In July 1944, an organization was formed called the Supreme Ukrainian Liberation Council. This organization trying to take under its umbrella a lot of these small, disconnected, and very poorly trained Ukrainian guerrilla organizations that had been operating very ineffectively throughout the Ukrainian countryside. And in July of 44, they developed a manifesto, based on really 4 points. The first point is absolutely positively central. Ukraine is a nation of yeoman farmers. It's a point of pride in the Ukrainian mentality. And all Ukrainians who want a plot of land that could support themselves and their families will be granted a plot of land if they desire it. Again, this is something that Hitler could have done, and it never even crossed his mind. Number two, that any sense of a large landowning class, a large banking class, a large industrial class will be eliminated. Justice will be achieved through the proper redistribution of land, of income, and of control over industrial enterprises. That is to say that if we take democracy seriously, and most people don't, we want not just, you know, politics to be democratic, but we want the factories, we want the farms to be democratic, we want the municipalities to be democratic. We want the entire organization of the society to manifest the concept, this concept that I'm going to talk about again and again and again, soborno pravanie, the rule of the council, the rule of the council at every layer, not just of government, but of every layer of power and authority. The manifesto's third point says that we will eliminate every possible vestige of Marxism and socialism, at least in the way that the Soviets have imposed it upon us. And last but not least, we will permit full freedom. Full freedom of economic investment, full freedom of movement, full freedom of speech, and of religion. This is the manifesto that galvanized a relatively strong, however doomed, but relatively strong and popular Ukrainian resistance movement that really gets its act together in the middle of 1944. By the middle of 1944, it's clear that the German invasion has been completely spent, but it's also clear that the Red Army has also suffered severe damage. And if there's ever a chance of a real Ukrainian independence, it's right now. And we have to take advantage of it right now. At the same time, militant armed group is formed called the Ukrainian Insurgent Army. Its commander is General Roman Shushkevich. This group, this the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, is anti-Nazi and anti-communist. And there's very good reason to be anti-Nazi at this time, and even better reason to be anti-communist at this time. In 1943, it was very clear that the SS taking orders from Himmler, and if you read Himmler's Posen speech, it's very clear that Himmler, and I could quote this if I could get my hands on it, that the Russians will be slave laborers for the Germans. That includes the Ukrainians. The SS, even as early as 1943, I believe the Posen speech was 44, but I could be wrong on that. But it's clear that mentality was already being put in place in 1943, and so Viktor Lutz, the head of the SS in Ukraine, is killed by the UPA. At the same time, in March 1944, Valutin, who is the Soviet head of the Ukrainian front, is also assassinated. It becomes very clear that this Ukrainian insurgent army is a very serious force. The problem is it is not being supplied, certainly not being supplied by the USSR, certainly not being supplied by the Germans. It has to arm and train itself as best as it can. It can capture weapons from dead soldiers, from abandoned magazines. It does what it can, but even under these circumstances, it is acting as a relatively powerful institution. In fact, it becomes so powerful that after the war is over, in 1946, Stalin will, in a rage, he will order 15 full-strength divisions of the MVD to hunt them down and destroy. MVD is that part of the NKVD that specializes strictly in internal security. Remember, NKVD and the later KGB are composite organizations. You know, the KGB deals not just with foreign espionage, but it also deals with internal security. It also deals with the control of the border. It also controls the political prisons. So these are huge organizations. The NKVD and the KGB are the combination, like in America, they'd be the combination of the CIA, the FBI, the DEA, military intelligence. They'd be the combination of a whole bunch of organizations. And in fact, they had their own infantry, they had their own air force, they had their own tanks and armor, they had their own heavy weapons. So, you know, you really can't compare the KGB to the CIA. That's not how it works. So the MVD was that part of the NKVD that specialized in internal security operations. They were the highest trained of all of these organizations. They were screened For physical strength, intelligence, as well as a fanatical dedication to the Soviet Union and what it stands for. So in other words, they were absolutely loyal figures. So by 46, 15 full divisions of the MVD were sent after the Ukrainian insurgent army. And it's cognate groups, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. There were other groups like this that really were struggling against both sides. Even more than this, the Ukrainian insurgent army became so powerful that Stalin even went so far as to create a full Polish, Czechoslovak, and Russian combined military entity, combined military force, after we were talking 46, 47 now, to completely root out, destroy, and burn their headquarters, their areas, the lands they control, the villages that were sympathetic to them. I know from interviewing good friends of mine, Olga Polosky, who I lived with briefly, who was an immigrant, World War II immigrant from Ukraine, and a good friend of mine. I had asked her straight out about this, and she told me that both the insurgent army and the OUN really operated in this vacuum created by the damage done to the Soviets as well as the defeat of the Germans. And because they could trust neither side, they had to create their own institutions. That's what made them dangerous. That's what said to Stalin, I have to use every ounce of military, elite military force I can to not just kill these guys, not just eliminate their families, but to poison the lands that they live on and to completely annihilate the villages that have been sympathetic to them in the past. But around this time, roughly 400, including the Plosky family, and I know this again from hearing it from them firsthand, were finally able to escape to the American zone in Berlin at the end of the war. 1946-1947, the political arm of this movement, the UPA, actually was able to form, briefly, a independent Ukrainian public in the extreme part of Western Ukraine. And very few people know this, but they were still functioning underground in 1956, and the Ukrainian insurgent army was also involved in fighting Soviet tanks in Hungary in 1956 during the invasion. And there's always been rumors circulating that the Ukrainian insurgent army has always been around, 40s, 50s, 60s, even into the 70s, harassing Soviet installations and party personnel. Of course, it was never reported on in the Soviet press. Real information is very hard to come by on those issues. The last thing I want to talk about before we go is really the ideological core here. The Ukrainian Insurgent Army, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the UPA, a political umbrella organization that led the resistance, also had a manifesto of 5 points. Number one, to maintain morale, which is obviously pretty important when Stalin is destroying villages where your family and friends live. Number two, propagandize. Let's talk about the faith. Let's talk about Ukrainian nationalism, our heroes, the glory of our past, our incredibly fertile soil. What would independence really be for us? How wealthy could we be? Number three, to educate Ukrainians secretly, to try to undo the damage done by the official schools. Number four, acts of terror against forced deportation. So in other words, if there was a train deporting Ukrainians to, say, Siberia or Kazakhstan, that the UPA forces and their allies would blow up the tracks, would shoot the engineer, that sort of thing. And lastly, to constantly harass the MVD. I mean, we know that there's no way that they could have won any kind of classic frontal battle, but snipers, booby traps, poisoning their food, all of this was done. So, you know, the leader of this in 1938, one of the early leaders, Ivan Konovalets, was assassinated by NKVD in Rotterdam. In 1959, the head of one of the more militant wings of the insurgents, Stepan Bandera, was assassinated in Munich, I believe, by the KGB putting a bomb in a box of chocolates. I could be wrong on that, but I think that's exactly what happened. So by the 1960s, the Soviets changed tactics. Khrushchev began a massive wave of arrests against anyone even remotely close to the UPA, OUN, or any of its cognates, as well as increasing the destruction of Ukrainian churches, simply destroying them, leveling them. Some of the political prisoners under Khrushchev, and then after his fall in 1964, some of the major prisoners were Ukrainians and other dissidents were kept. They began experimenting in drugs. Two drugs in particular that the MVD had developed, amenazine, which is something like thorazine, as well as sulfazine. These two drugs were designed, at least in their very primitive state, to, sulfazine was a torture drug because it was used against inflammation. But you'd give overdoses of this stuff and it would cause searing cramps. It would cause extremely high fevers. Amenazine was used on children to get them to tell on their parents, so they'd kind of get they'd get high, like giving them a small dose of thorazine, and then in their state they would say, oh yeah, my father is UPA or whatever it is. So that was the nature of these methods of resistance. These are the ways that the Soviet Union dealt with any kind of real resistance, and it should teach us something about what a tyrannical government can do to control its population. But the whole mentality of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, founded in 1929, you know, this idea is to build a militant, fanatical military corps that can appeal to the youth, that can appeal to the alienated youth who hate the Soviet system and who realize that not all acts of terror are bad. What we're talking about here are acts of resistance. And so these are heroes. These are people who we should emulate at one time, maybe in the not-so-near future. These are people who we should study and who we should understand. They are true heroes. They are true heroes. So I want to thank everybody for listening. I know I went a little long today. I apologize for that. I want to thank all my friends. I want to thank my critics. I want to thank anyone who takes this seriously, and the Voice of Reason, as always. Steve and Mike have been good friends of mine, and I want to thank you for everything. God bless, and bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
tuned in to Radio Arian